Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with talks underway as lawmakers meet to fund the rest of fiscal 2014 through September and look for ways around the sequester to mitigate more deep cuts coming in mid-January. Scott Klinger, the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Centre for Effective Government, joins us to discuss the effects of cuts so far and the impact of much more to come. Then, with billionaire Bill Gross of PIMCO calling on his fellow one percenters to pay more taxes to spur economic growth and help those who use their hands for a living, we will examine the growing disparity in wealth in America with Harvard researcher Michael Norton, a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, who has studied the reasons why most Americans are unaware of how wide the income gap is. And when told how much more of the nation's wealth is going to the top, rich and poor alike agree it is unfair and un-American, but then disagree on how to address the problem. Then finally, we'll examine the role of Rafael Cruz, the director of the Purifying Fire Ministry, who recently campaigned with his son, Senator Ted Cruz, in Iowa. Best-selling author Frank Schaefer, whose parents Francis and Edith were the founders of what has become the Christian right, joins us to discuss the Christian Reconstruction Dominionist movement, which seeks to rule America according to biblical law, and Pastor Cruz's remarks that Obama is an outright Marxist who should be sent back to Kenya, and his belief that the United States is a Christian nation formed to honor the Word of God. Joining us now is Scott Klinger, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He is a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And lawmakers met on Wednesday, and they'll meet again in a couple of weeks to figure out how to mitigate the effects of the next round of sequester cuts due in mid-January and to deal with the current ones. And what's your sense, though? Because you have a division here. The Senate wants to get rid of the sequester altogether, but the House has decided this is a great way to cut government spending except for defense.
Right. Well, you may remember that the sequester started in 2011 when we had an impasse similar to the one we just went through. And it was set in place as something that no one thought would ever happen. It was so draconian and so bad that they put it in place to make sure the super committee would find an agreement on the budget. And when they didn't, starting in March, the sequester went into effect. It's basically spending cuts on autopilot. They're indiscriminate. They cut both the domestic side of the budget and the military side evenly. At least they were supposed to. The military side got a bit of a reprieve last year when they put off $20 billion of military cuts in 2013, and those are supposed to be catch up on in this current year. But basically, the sequester is really hurting jobs, and Congressional Budget Office estimated that somewhere between 300,000 and 1.6 million jobs could be added if we got rid of the sequester. And so, you know, I think many Americans are really thinking we have a jobs crisis, not much less of a deficit crisis than we used to have.
Well, we demonstrably don't have a deficit crisis because the deficit is going down at record speed.
That's right. It's fallen more than in half since 2009 when President Obama came to office, and it was down over $400 billion last year alone.
So is this economic illiteracy on the part of the conservatives in the House with their obsession over deficits, or are deficits a stalking horse for their real obsession and their real goal, which is to cut the taxes on the rich? Because it doesn't make any sense when an economy is barely recovering to throw a lot of people out of work.
Well, you know, it doesn't make any sense, and it's really hurting America's competitiveness in the world. We find that we're less competitive in terms of having an educated workforce. We're much less competitive in terms of the research and development that we're able to do. Our country used to lead the world in research and development. We're rapidly falling behind. investing in research is a way to create new jobs. We think of all the things from life-saving drugs to technology to internet. All have roots in federally funded either university contracts or government-funded labs. So we're really cutting ourselves short by focusing only on the math and not on the people. Government should be about people and about making sure we all have an opportunity for a dignified and successful life. And when we have these automatic cuts, we're not paying attention to those priorities.
So is anybody listening to the director of the National Institute of Health who's saying that, you know, that we're cutting programs that might have the next breakthrough to cure cancer, or we're firing investigators who could be tomorrow's Nobel Prize winners? I mean, and when you've got the director of the FBI basically saying that, you know, they can't operate with this huge cut that they've gone through, an $800 million cut, and now they're going to have an even, I think it's almost twice it, isn't it, coming up?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, all these agencies, including one that, you know, we're trained not to like in terms of the IRS, but they're cutting enforcement officers, and they're doing far less audits than they used to, primarily of rich people and of corporations. And every dollar they spend on auditing, they get at least $6 back in added revenue. So, you know, there's just really nonsensical, non-business-like approaches to this when we just put the government on autopilot and don't think about what we want to invest in and the kind of country we want to have.
And, of course, in a curious and ironic way, we kind of breathed a sigh of relief after the closure of the government ended and the threat to tank the economy ended recently. But we went back to this terrible situation, right? The sequester.
Well, we think of the sequester as a rolling shutdown. You know, if people remember there were furloughs of government workers all throughout last year. That's going to continue for the next 9 years. Unless we do something about that, and government offices closed when people need those services. So it's really, you know, a trickle of the shutdown that we had in a big way earlier this month. We're going to see that on a rolling basis going forward.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Klinger, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shares Prosperity and as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. So who's meeting in these panels of lawmakers that are trying to figure out a way around the sequester and a way to avoid these even more draconian cuts coming in mid-January?
Well, there's 29 members of the House and Senate, and it's heavily weighted towards senators. But it looks like the hard negotiations, are going to be done largely by Senator Patty Murray and Congressman Paul Ryan, the heads of each of their chambers' budget committees. And that's caused some consternation among some of the conference members in terms of not wanting, you know, to just have a two-person deal negotiated out of the public eye. And we have concerns about that as well. So the next time we'll hear something should be right before Thanksgiving. They hope to have some sort of plan, or at least basis of agreement that they can move a budget forward. And then after that, I think the plan is to send it back to the appropriations committees, where they'll come up with specific spending targets for each function of the government, probably by the end of the year if they're able to.
So there's no way to do a reality check on asking the principal and most important question is, why are we doing this in the first place? Because conditions have changed, right? We don't have a budget crisis. We have an employment crisis. Furthermore, we have an income distribution crisis, and we have a crisis in a failing middle class, not to mention a stressed-out working class.
And a failure to invest adequately to ensure a bright future for our country and our economy.
So it's almost like the lawmakers are on autopilot as much as the sequester itself is cuts by autopilot.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they're preoccupied by other agendas, and they're not paying attention to the people's business.
So what's your sense then of given that you say that this panel of lawmakers that are negotiating weighted heavily in the Senate's favor, they think this thing's a mistake in the first place. Where does the White House stand?
Well, the White House is I think, one of the big question marks where they stand. They have not been as supportive of new revenue as we would hope they would in terms of closing offshore tax loopholes and some of the other major giveaways that are in the tax code. One thing I just recently learned is that we spend money both through allowing corporations and wealthy people not to pay taxes by giving them tax credits and tax loopholes. So we spend money on the tax side of the budget, and we also spend money on the spending side, where the government writes checks to operate programs. And those two ways we spend money are pretty equal. In fact, we spend more money by giving tax breaks and tax loopholes than we do on all the programs that we associate with the federal government that are not the entitlement programs, the discretionary programs. So we really think we need to look at cutting spending on the tax expenditure side of the budget. We hope that's what the Senate stands for. We think they do. And we'll see where the White House falls out in that.
But if the House members of this panel are weighted in favor of relieving the Pentagon of the cuts, the automatic cuts in the sequester, and then piling them back on to the domestic side of the budget, what's the prognosis there?
That's one of the worst outcomes that we can have, I think, that A, it sets a really bad precedent for the future, and B, it doesn't meet the basic needs and needs to invest that we have that are going on right now. So exactly what you described, replacing the defense cuts with more cuts on the social side and domestic side is probably one of the worst outcomes that can come out of this process.
But we've already had an indication that that's what's happened already, right? Didn't you say that they spared $20 billion of the Pentagon's cuts?
Yeah, so they got a special deal last year, and they were supposed to make up that $20 billion this year. So in part, the lines coming out of Congress are, well, look, the defense is getting cut so much more this year than the other side of the budget. Well, that's because they got a $20 billion break last year that they didn't have to come up with.
Well, obviously, the whole sequester could be solved if they canceled the useless F-35 fighter program, fighter bomber, everything. You know, it's an all-in-one plane that doesn't do anything very particularly well. And it is the biggest weapon system in history, and it's a complete turkey.
Doesn't work, right? Yeah.
I mean, if you got rid of that, you'd probably take care of the entire sequester, wouldn't you?
At least several years of it. And there's a number of things like that. Another one is closing the offshore tax loopholes, which raises about $220 billion over 10 years. So there's certainly a number of things that could be done that would harm very few people. It might harm some moneyed interests and some defense contractors, but the average American would not be worse off for making some of these changes. But I think part of the problem, Ian, is that we are stuck on thinking we still need to cut. And as you said earlier, the budget deficit's come way down. It's scarcely a problem, and yet we continue to have the conversations around, well, how can we replace the cuts with other cuts? And we think we really need to shift the conversation to think about what kind of country we want, what do we need to invest in, what kind of research do we need, what infrastructure do we need to fix, how can we help our kids in school, both in elementary school and high school, and also afford college. These are the questions that aren't getting asked that are being subsumed to the conversation about austerity, and that's what we need to change.
Well, just before you go, Scott Klinger, I'd like to get you to comment on Bill Gross of PIMCO has put on his website he's obviously got a lot of people that follow him. He's considered a kind of guru. He's the bond king. And he says, a fair economic system should always allow for an opportunity to succeed. Congratulations. Smoke that cigar. Enjoy that Chateau Lafite 1989. But most of you guys should acknowledge your good fortune at having been born in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, entering the male-dominated workforce 25 years later, and having had the privilege of riding a credit wave and a credit boom for the past three decades. You did not, as President Obama averred, build that. You did not create that wave, you rode it. And now it's time to kick out and share some of your good fortune by paying higher taxes or reforming them to favor economic growth and labor, as opposed to corporate profits and individual gazillions.
You know, I really celebrate the statement by Bill Gross, and I think what's most important is that we all tell ourselves a story about who we are and how we've gotten where we are. And for him to acknowledge that, you know, it's not all about him, that he had support from society, he had the luck of being born at a good time, he had all the privileges of being white and male and American in this world, and he understands that he owes something back, and I think we need a lot more people like Bill Gross.
And do you think that there is a chance that, I mean, if you got the, in terms of sequester, you got the head of the FBI saying this is a catastrophe, nobody seems to be listening to him. Are anybody listening to that Bill Gross is in the, and the Warren Buffetts amongst the hedge funds, billionaires, and the those that only pay 15% tax?
Well, you know, when they get organized, I think they provide an interesting voice, especially in Congress. One of my previous jobs was working as the co-director of Responsible Wealth, where we organized millionaires and billionaires to keep the estate tax. And, you know, people listened to them. And I think, you know, the estate tax has been decimated quite a bit from what it used to be, but we still have it. And I think it's in part because the people who would pay it stood up and said it's a fair tax, it's a good tax, and we should keep it. People like Bill Gates' dad and George Soros and Warren Buffett and many others. So I think what Bill Gross is doing is important. I hope other people rally around him and say, yeah, I agree with Bill. And maybe we'll see a movement of the one percenters for economic justice. That'd be a nice thing to see.
Well, we're going to continue the conversation on income disparity in this country. So I thank you very much, Scott Klinger, for joining us here.
It's always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Klinger, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a researcher who's done an analysis on why people in America don't believe the income gap is as wide as it is and that all the wealth is going to the top.
Are gone and the bank says nay. I beg in the places where I used to pay, and I'm crazy for cash, but I ain't got none. Oh, I'm just paying my rent every day. Oh, and there's a hour of debt.
Though we have fun, tax collectors getting closer, still we have fun. There's nothing surer, the rich get rich and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Norton, a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School and the co-author with Elizabeth Dunn of the new book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Norton.
Thank you.
And you're quoted in an article at CNN, Seven Ways to Narrow the Rich-Poor Gap, in terms of why it is that people don't realize how wide the gap is between the rich and the poor in this country. What does your research tell us?
So we asked a large sample of Americans a couple of very, very simple questions about how wealth is distributed right now in the United States. We basically said, think of five groups of people from the very richest to the very poorest. How much of the wealth do you think each of those groups has? And how much of the wealth would you like them to have? And the very first thing we saw is that, so for example, people thought the wealthiest 20% of Americans had about 60% of the wealth. It turns out they have about 85%. So they're wrong by 25%, if you do the math, an enormous amount in terms of understanding just how unequal wealth is distributed in the United States right now.
And why do you think that is? Is it because it's happened so fast and it's exacerbated, the gap has grown so greatly? So what's the explanation?
I think that is absolutely part of it, that certainly the United States has not always been this unequally distributed in terms of wealth. In fact, the last time in American history that things were this unequally distributed was the day before the Great Depression, which is an interesting historical analogy. But I think even aside from the recent growth in inequality, there's just the idea that in general, we don't see a lot of inequality in our everyday lives. You know, we tend to live in towns and in neighborhoods with people like us. We're aware that there are very wealthy people, and we're aware that there are very poor people, but we don't tend to see them every day, and it makes us feel when we look around that probably wealth is more equally distributed than it is.
So this does really, it seems like our mythology needs to be overhauled, don't you think? I mean, if we still think we're living the American dream, then it's clearly out of step with reality.
You know, in fact, the other question that we ask people, in addition to what do you think the current distribution is, we also ask people, what would you like it to be if it were up to you, if you could start over from scratch? And there people tell us that they want the richest 20% to have something like 35 to 40% of the wealth. So it's not as though Americans want a perfectly equal society. They absolutely do not. But they want rich people to have more money so that, you know, if you work hard, you can get ahead. But again, the rich currently have 85%. People thought they had 60. They want them to have 40. We're really talking about really drastic differences in people's ideals compared to the way things are right now.
And do you think people have any idea of what's been driving this gulf between the rich and the poor?
You know, so it certainly was the case that the increase started to happen more dramatically in the 1980s. Wealth was more equally distributed through the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And some of those increases were driven by changes in tax policy in the 1980s and other policies in the 1980s. Some of inequality, and many people have written about this, is driven by technology, that tends to create unequal distributions of wealth as well. So some things are government policies. Some things are other things that are happening in the world. I think people have some idea that these things sum up to inequality, but it's a little bit unclear how.
Well, one of the statistics that I find extraordinary is that the Walton family, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, the children of the founder, Sam Walton, their collective wealth is the equivalent of the entire wealth of the lower 40% of all Americans. I mean, that's a pretty stark and unbelievable statistic, isn't it?
It is extraordinary. And in fact, if you look at the bottom 20% of Americans, they basically have zero net wealth overall because many of them are in debt, and even those who are not don't have any wealth. So, and again, wealth different from income. So you can have a decent income, but in fact have negative wealth because you're in debt. And it's really with wealth that we really see dramatic disparities in people's outcomes in America.
But Michael Norton, isn't that where the change happened in the 1980s? We were effectively a social democracy from 1947 to 1977. And then starting under President Reagan, and particularly under his chairman of the Fed, Alan Greenspan, credit became incredibly easy. So money got cheap and credit was encouraged. In other words, credit has become a kind of coping mechanism. Instead of wages improving, credit was made available to give people the illusion that they were maintaining a high standard of living or maintaining the same standard of living. Is that where it began?
I think, you know, that's part of it. And I think, you know, if you look at specific tax policies, so for example, the tax on the wealthiest Americans at one time in American history, the tax rate was 90%, which seems unfathomable that there could have been a tax rate of 90%.
And that was under a Republican president, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
And so we're thinking about, you know, a very, very different time that wasn't so long ago when our tax system was very, very different. And even one simple policy like the estate tax, you know, if you can hand things down to the next generation without tax, you're really going to perpetuate inequality in a way that you don't if those estates are taxed. Now, reasonable people can disagree about whether we should tax you passing things on to your children, but certainly it is the case that it does keep inequality the same as it is now.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Norton, a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, and the co-author with Elizabeth Dunn of the new book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. So in terms of coping mechanisms, we mentioned how credit has given people the illusion that their standard of living is being maintained while their wages have been flat since the 1970s. It also would seem to me that another sociological change that's quite profound is women in the workforce and spouses joining the workforce. And I just read a recent statistic, I think it was a Pew study, that indicates that over 40% of American households are now headed by a woman who is the primary breadwinner.
You know, we also see, of course, that many more Americans now, another huge change that's maybe contributing, many more Americans now work more than one job than used to be the case. In part, as you said, the minimum wage has not increased. Middle-class incomes have stagnated. That drives both people in the household to need to have jobs, both the husband and the wife, and also each of those people to have possibly more than one job each. And that's a very dramatic shift in terms of everyday life for America. Those changes are driven in part by this enormous increase in inequality.
So what do you think, would the first solution be to tax the rich?
So we have asked people in our survey, so we can tell Americans. The other thing I should say, when we ask, you know, rich people and poor people, we can ask Republicans and Democrats. Every group that we've asked, when we say, how would you like America to look? Every single group we've ever surveyed says they'd like things to be more equal than they are now. Even the most conservative, wealthy people, still, when they find out that the top 20% have almost all the wealth, and as we said, the bottom 20% have nothing, those people, even though it's not necessarily in their interest, those people even say, this is too unequal, this is not the kind of America that I want to live in. However, when we ask people what should be done about it, that's where we get back into the many, many partisan debates that we hear about on the news every day. So, for example, universal health care is a possible way to decrease inequality. And we all know that different sides of the debate have different views on the wisdom of universal health care.
So, but how does a society become less of a social democracy? Is there, if the turning point was in the 1980s, what can you point to apart from the ascendance of Ronald Reagan?
I think, you know, that there were some changes. So when things are going well in a country, as they, even though we had some brief recessions in the early 1980s, in general, when things are going well in a country, there's less of a focus on the social safety net and more of a focus on economic growth. And you see this in a sort of a cyclical fashion over time. So, you know, in New York City, when dealing with homeless people, the population of homeless people has increased and decreased dramatically as a function of how well that state is doing. It often is a reflection then of, well, there are more homeless people. Now we need to focus on the social safety net instead of economic growth. And you see kind of the pendulum swing back and forth over time at a city level, but also at a national level. What is the biggest problem that we're trying to address right now? And it does tend to be cyclical in unpredictable ways, but it will often come back around to the other perspective.
So then, would it be helpful if we were more honest with ourselves as a society and stopped talking about our great democracy and discuss the extent to which we have become an oligarchy or a plutonomy, how the Horatio Alger myth simply doesn't apply? Certainly, it's not alive and well anymore, that perhaps we are less of a meritocracy than we think we are, and that essentially we've become a class society.
You know, I think it's a very important point, because another attitude that we've surveyed is not just current inequality, but what about social mobility? So one of the most important ways to change the level of inequality in a society is to measure the extent to which someone who is poor, whose parents are poor, could in their own lifetime become wealthy. And the reverse as well. Is it the case that wealthy people can end up poor? We've done surveys on this as well, and it turns out that, similar to our research on wealth, people believe that there's an enormous amount of social mobility in the United States. They believe in the rags to riches kind of story. In the data, though, we don't see it. So there's been a great decrease in social mobility in the United States. And in fact, we now have lower mobility than many European countries. So we've really changed a bit in terms of not just how things are right now, but also the chances that people have going forward to really change their outcomes in life. And for many Americans, that's much more disturbing, because it really is central to America to say, this is a land of opportunity where people can, you know, we have the phrase, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. If that's being violated as well, that's a whole other series of problems to deal with.
So, Michael Norton, again, professor of business administration at Harvard's Business School and co-author with Elizabeth Dunn of the new book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. We're talking about research that Michael has done on the widening gap between the rich and poor in this country. And when you have the billionaires like Warren Buffett saying that I pay a lower tax rate than my secretary does, when you have Bill Gates' father saying, you know, you can't sail two yachts at the same time, that the rich are just simply getting too rich. Buffett, I think, warned that our economy is becoming a plantation economy. These people are laying it on the line, and you'd think that if, as a society, we worship the wealthy and admire billionaires, some of these billionaires are trying to tell us something. So why isn't that resonating?
They really are. And Warren Buffett, in addition to advocating for better wages, he's also the Buffett pledge is he's trying to convince billionaires to commit to giving most of their money away to charity. And some people have really taken the pledge and said, as Warren Buffett is, giving an enormous amount of their money to charity. So absolutely, these are business people who are saying perhaps things have gotten a little bit too far toward unequal and maybe something should be done about it. I think it resonates with people, but it's not clear that people trust government to solve the problem. So even when you are thinking that the inequality is too great, when we survey Americans, it's not clear, and you can see the current perception of the U.S. government by American citizens, it's not clear that they trust government to be effective at doing anything, whether it's giving health care or even addressing inequality. So a little bit citizens are unclear where to turn, even if you wanted things to change. What is the agency or entity that can affect that change? Previously in American history, people have trusted government to make those sorts of changes. Now, given the perceptions of government being able to get anything done, I think there is a void in terms of where do we look if we want these changes to happen.
And the crash of healthcare.gov, I guess, just reinforces that perception.
Exactly.
So, Michael Norton, what, though, drives this? I know I've asked this question before, but I wanted to get more specific into the notion that why do the rich get richer, and at such a greater pace in the recent decades? And I'm wondering whether that's connected in any way to the financialization of our economy, where more and more our economy is dominated by Wall Street. And as you know, most of the very rich on Wall Street are these hedge fund managers who, by the way, pay carried interest, so they only pay capital gains of 15%. And that's one of the things that I think Warren Buffett was referring to. You know, and we know that from the last election with Mitt Romney having to admit that he only paid 13% on his income because he was making money out of money. And it seems to me that what's happening here is that we have a new form of capitalism, not where, you know, the robber barons were producing goods and services, but nowadays we seem to be economy is dominated by people making money out of money, and hedge funds, of course, take the money from the wealthy and then maximize that and make money for themselves at the same time. So is that what's driving it?
I think many economists have pointed to that as a factor. I think even outside of the domain of financial products, if you think even about the other kinds of products that are in the marketplace now, Apple, for example, needs very, very few employees to dominate an enormous amount of consumer spending in a way that Ford needed many, many employees to churn out cars in the 1950s when they were a huge part of the economy. So there's been a real shift in terms of the products that people are interested in buying and the amount of human capital required to produce those. That means that partly when we think about the middle class shrinking, in part, and many economists have noted this as well, it's driven by the fact that consumer products don't require the kind of labor that they once did, and therefore there aren't those kinds of jobs available for people that could then leverage them into greater wealth and greater income over time. There's been such a shift in consumption that partly underlies many of these trends.
And what about this recent change from Citizens United decision on the Supreme Court where now unlimited amounts of money can be given by both corporations, individuals, and unions. And, of course, the union movement is down to about 6% of the private workforce now. So they have, over the years, diminished in influence, and that may well be a part of why the income gap has grown. But there's no question now with a few billionaires like the Koch brothers weighing in with unlimited money, which, by the way, is dark money. It's not even attributed. And efforts to attribute it are being blocked. In fact, Senator Cruz just put a hold on, it's been released since, on the FCC chair, simply because he doesn't want him to force the television advertising for politicians to reveal where they get their money from. So we can see that the wealthy or parts of the some of the wealthy in this country are aggressively trying to buy our politics, and there's nothing to stop them.
I think it's probably too soon to measure the full impact of changes in campaign finance reform. Obviously, campaign finance reform came about because there was a concern many years ago that rich people were able to have too much influence. The kinds of trends we see now aren't necessarily the same as they were before that, but it will be very interesting to see if these sorts of changes increase the extent to which we're seeing changes in inequality over time.
Well, just in closing then, Michael Norton, you said that when, in your research, when you poll people, when they find out the real disparity in wealth in this country, which is so much worse than what they think it is, that they're alarmed, and even the very wealthy find that it's not healthy to have 80% of the wealth in the hands of the top 20%. And then within that statistic, I understand that that's only what I think 400 people that control something like a huge percentage of the wealth within that. So
yeah,
you can see the concentration is getting greater and greater in the hands of fewer and fewer people. That disturbs people. It even disturbs the wealthy. But yet when you then go to the next question is, what do we do about it? Then it gets tricky.
That's exactly right. So if we ask liberals what should be done, most liberals will say things like the minimum wage should be increased or taxes should be increased on the wealthy. Often when we ask conservatives the same question, again, they are as alarmed and surprised as liberals at the current level of inequality. But conservatives, on average, trust government less. They'll often say that it should be addressed, for example, through private charitable contributions, which is another way, of course, of changing wealth inequality within a country. And the government solving it versus private charitable contributions solving the problem, those two groups agree that there's a problem, but their solutions are so dramatically different that it's very hard to get consensus in the political conversation to do something about this issue.
But nobody's addressing the structural side of it, right? If you just say, you know, either the government gives poor people more money or charities give poor people money, that's not addressing the structural problem.
Yes, I think to truly change the level of inequality in a country or even within a community, it requires, you're absolutely right, structural changes. One of the biggest changes, of course, is equality in early childhood education. Education is an enormous predictor of outcomes later in life. If there's inequality with education, there is going to be inequality later in life, regardless of any other policies. Again, though, conservatives and liberals disagree about how best to tackle childhood education. Even if they believe it's important, they have such different views on how to make it effective that, again, you see this lack of consensus in the political discourse.
Well, Michael Norton, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Norton, who's a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School and the co-author with Elizabeth Dunn of the new book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the role of Rafael Cruz, the director of the Purifying Fire Ministry, who recently campaigned with his son, Senator Ted Cruz, in Iowa. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Frank Schaefer, who is a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. His novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, Sex, Mom and God, and his latest just out is And God Said Billy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Schaefer.
Hey, thanks, Ian. Nice to talk with you.
And Rafael Cruz, the father of Ted Cruz, who is the director of the Purifying Fire Ministry, he has said some pretty outrageous things when he was stumping for his son for U.S. Senator in his successful run in Texas. He said that Obama was an outright Marxist who seeks to destroy all concepts of God, and he urged these Tea Party crowds to send Obama back to Kenya. But now there's a long speech he gave very recently to a Tea Party group in Hood County, Texas, where he really expounds on this idea that the United States is a Christian nation and that the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution were divine revelations from God. So I wanted to ask you about this this movement that has been identified as the Christian Reconstructionist or Dominionist movement, who want to seek the rule of America to be ruled according to biblical law, which is apparently what Ted Cruz's father believes and others.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Ian, we live in a country where we have religious freedom, and one of the things that spins out of that is a reticence on the part of people like you and me and other commentators to really talk about what people believe in the sphere of what we call personal religion. But of course, in the case of people like Ted Cruz, the personal part has jumped the tracks into the political and the public. And so I think it's perfectly legitimate to look at Ted Cruz or his father and family and just say, hey, what do these folks believe and how has that impacted things like, for instance, the shutdown or risking the faith and credit of the United States globally or this anti-government movement? And the problem is when you peel back a little bit of a layer with Ted Cruz, you find his father, but you also find a long connection with the far right of the evangelical movement. And of course, back in the 70s and the early 80s, I was connected with that movement too. And I knew people like Recess Rushdoony and others who founded the Reconstructionist or Theonomist movement within evangelicalism, which was really nothing more than hard-bitten traditional Calvinism, going all the way back to the reformer John Calvin, which tried to build a theocratic state in places like Geneva and other countries in Europe. And so I think what we have to understand here in the U.S. is that folks like Ted Cruz's dad come from a wing of evangelical Christianity, which really is the American equivalent of something like what the mullahs have been doing in Iran in an Islamic state. If these folks were given the best of all worlds as they would understand it, America truly would be a Christian nation according to their lights, in that other voices would be suppressed. Gay people would be eliminated, maybe literally, in the case of some of the Reconstructionists. You would have a state that essentially banned other religions from the public sphere. And when you see their antipathy toward Barack Obama, aside from race, which is a big issue with these groups, because a lot of them are run and cater to older white people with a heavy preponderance in the southern states. But even if you eliminate that, what you find is a level of bigotry, which most Americans really don't share, no matter what their point of view. So this is certainly not all Republicans. It's not the traditional Republicans in the Republican Party that I was friends with back in the 70s and 80s, people like Congressman Jack Kemp and others who I knew well, or my dad, Francis Schaefer, knew when we were working with them.
These folks are really a different type of evangelical, a very radical evangelical. And what's interesting about it is not that they exist, because every culture, as you know, has little fringe groups in it. But these folks have really shaped the Tea Party movement. And so when you look at things like the Pew Research polls and you find that 60 to 70% of Tea Party members identify themselves as conservative evangelicals, that is the type of conservative evangelical that they are. And so, of course, there's a smattering of libertarians and Ayn Rand fans and others thrown in. But really, when you take away the hard-bitten evangelical right-wing core from the Tea Party, then you don't have a Ted Cruz, you don't have the shutdown, you don't have the faith and credit of the United States risked. And so you've got a completely different political picture. So really, the Reconstruction has come out of a philosophical movement that came out of the 1960s in reaction precisely to the 60s. By people like Rusesh Rajdhani, David Chilton, and other theologians that most Americans have never heard of, that had a tremendous influence in the, for instance, beginnings of the homeschool movement, which was started not to educate primarily, but to remove kids from culture, protect them, for instance, from science, geology, the teaching of evolution, views of sexuality or gay lifestyles that would have been abhorrent to these people, a kind of a protective enclave. All of that came out of this Reconstructionist movement. So when you fast forward up to the shutdown and you look at, for instance, Ted Cruz's dad, you know, I wrote a piece in Pathos.com, which is a progressive religious site, and I put a rather provocative headline on it at the beginning of the shutdown, which simply read, "Ted Cruz's father is a rabid right-wing preacher. What more do you need to know about the why of the shutdown?" And the fact of the matter is that actually has a lot to do with it, because secular commentators keep talking about, and during the shutdown, for instance, that it made no sense politically, that it would harm the GOP. How could anybody in their right mind do this? But what they don't understand is that the paradigm brought by folks like Ted Cruz, who is an evangelical right-wing Christian himself, as a long interview he gave to Word magazine in a video format proved when he spoke very much like his own father, that they posted in terms of his Christian vision of politics. When you look at where Ted Cruz and his fellow travelers have been coming from on the right in the GOP and the Tea Party, it's mostly from this type of evangelical background. And their agenda is very simple. They look at America as a fallen secular state that has to be returned to its Christian origins by whatever means necessary. They see the government as their enemy now, because the government is pluralistic and protects rights of people who have differing points of view, lifestyle, and all the rest of it. And so what you have here is a religious movement that has jumped the tracks into a political movement. And you mentioned at the beginning of the show that my new book, And God Said Billy, and by the way, it's a play on the name of Billy Graham, who is sort of one of the evangelical founders of the expansion of evangelicalism into our culture. But, you know, why I wrote And God Said Billy is very simple, and that is that I think that the subject of religious delusion that has insinuated itself into the mainstream culture through the Republican Party, the Tea Party element of it, really has not been explored and has not been honestly discussed by people. And so I think the mainstream media have been very reticent to say, hey, Ted Cruz's dad is a raving right-wing maniac, and Ted Cruz went to Harvard and went to law school. But the fact of the matter is he has retained a very radical set of fundamentalist Reconstructionist views that root right back into the poison that people like Rusesh Rajdhani brought into our culture by trying to reestablish Old Testament law as normative, taking the Bible completely literally in everything that it says, including the Old Testament, including the stoning of gay people, whatever it may be. This is why they regard the federal government as their enemy, because the federal government protects the rights of women, access to contraception, access to abortion, gay people to marry, et cetera, et cetera. They see the state as their enemy, and really are a very radical element. And Ted Cruz and these other guys come from that wing of the evangelical movement. And I'll say it again, you know, not all evangelicals are part of this. However, that wing controls very much the thinking of the religious element in the Tea Party. And a lot of their aggressive behavior against our government against health care reform and all the rest of it comes from the fact that they have accepted this reconstructionist view. And I think this is something we've really got to understand.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Schaefer, who's a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. However, he felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. And his novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma. And his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, Sex, Mom and God, and his latest, And God Said Billy. Now, there's no question in this video that's just online now of Rafael Cruz talking to the Tea Party in Texas, Hood County Tea Party. They were almost all fairly elderly white folks. There's no question about that. But I'm just curious to know how you could have a right-wing party in this country, given the recent history of these wars pursued in Muslim lands against people that they even describe the president as a Muslim, and then you have this insane. I mean, the fact that you know this theology that you're talking about is so similar to the Taliban, so similar to the mullahs in Iran that you referred to, that
right.
The U.S. is not just prosecuting wars against, but in right-wing culture, there's this phobia about them. So I don't understand how you could somehow have these beliefs and not notice how similar they are to those of your enemies.
Well, I think a lot of people who come from evangelical backgrounds like myself have seen that, and we have left. And what remains in terms of the driving force of the Republican Party, the kind of people that primary people because they're not far enough to the right, the sort of people that have taken over the gerrymandering process in the states that have gone into the Republican zone, as it were, irrevocably for a while. You know, these guys are quite radicalized, and they see themselves as a kind of a harbinger of things to come. They look at America as a battleground between Satan and themselves, between God and between the secular state. So they see things in very radical ways. I think a lot of more secular listeners or more moderately religious people don't understand something. And that is the problem with the shutdown and risking the faith and credit of the United States, this rightward tilt, is not the politics. It's the religion behind the politics. And the reason it's a problem is that when you divide the world into two categories only, saved and lost, us and them, black and white, and you use that in a theological sense, if you don't believe in Jesus, if you don't believe the Bible's inerrant, that every word written in it, it happened exactly as it was written, including Noah's Ark and all the rest of it, then you are an enemy. You are lost. You're not just lost. God does not approve of you. When that template is placed into the political arena, you no longer have policy debates about facts. You each bring your own facts to the table. And I'm not being facetious when I say this. Listen, I tweeted this once, and a lot of people retweeted it, and I think it sums it up. And it seriously, it sounds a little bit, you know, facetious, but it's not. I said, listen, you know, latest polls show that 73% of the American public blame the Republican Party for the shutdown. The rest believe that Noah had dinosaurs on the ark. Okay, that's a kind of a smart alecky statement, but the truth is that's the two Americas. You have one which brings this biblical literalism that the Reconstructionist movement represents to the table. You have another that is still trying to talk about policy, and they completely talk past each other. So people like Ted Cruz are not interested in what the numbers say. They're not interested in the Affordable Health Care Act in terms of what it will actually do. What they are interested in is deconstructing what they regard as an illegitimate secular state because it's pluralistic, it has room at the table for gay people, in the racial element in the South, often the black element is thrown in. It has room at the table for black people, worse, a black man in the White House. And then you get into the aspect of the apocalyptic thinking that goes with it, that we're all doomed anyway, Jesus is coming back soon, and what we have to do is make this stand here on earth while there's still time for Christ's kingdom. crazy as that all sounds, that's what these folks are after. And so when you look at Ted Cruz's dad and the kind of things he says, he's not an anomaly. This is typical of this group of people. And if you look, for instance, at some of the other congressional leaders and people in the Senate who are pretty radical and to the right these days from the Republican Party, Ted Cruz is not alone. You know, all you've got to check out is how many of these folks are elders, for instance, in extremely right-wing fundamentalist churches. How many of them have homeschooled their kids? How many of them continue at every opportunity to try to deny women access to contraceptives, let alone to choice in terms of abortion? So this is not one guy with a crazy dad and, you know, we're making a mountain out of a molehill. Ted Cruz is just a poster boy for a much larger issue. And so when you look at those 144 congressmen, you know, who voted against the settlement in terms of upping the debt limit, and who radically wanted to push us, our country, to the brink, actually into default, when you look at those guys, it's not an exaggeration to say that 80-90% of them are dedicated, committed, fundamentalist evangelical Christians who have some sort of tie-in to the Reconstructionist thinking. Take America back. It's been stolen from us. Well, who has done the stealing? Well, the rest of America. So we're no longer, those who are not in this group are no longer regarded as legitimate citizens. We are delegitimized in the same way that they have never accepted the presidency of Barack Obama. That this group of people has never regarded him as a legitimate president. And they've never accepted his presidency, just as they've never accepted the law in the Affordable Health Care Act. And so, as far as they're concerned, they are working on according to what they would regard as a higher law. So they're not bound by election results. They don't see themselves as bound by anything. And this is the kind of delusional behavior that this book of mine and God Said Billy is about. And it follows a guy who is completely religiously deluded and gets inside his head. And I hate to say it, but in a way, you know, I worked on this for a number of years coming up to this period. I was not writing specifically about the Tea Party. It turns out it was very prescient, because if you read And God Said Billy, you will know who Ted Cruz is. You will know who his dad is. You'll know who the Reconstructionists are. In fact, I even have passages where bits and pieces of Rusesh Rashtuni's rambling tirades against the educational system and against even kindergarten, which he calls a form of infanticide. These are the people who are heroes to them, because right. He thinks children ought to be home with their mothers being indoctrinated in Bible studies, and so kindergarten's infanticide. Mm-hmm. These are the people that Ted Cruz was raised on. These are the heroes to people like his father. And most Americans are too embarrassed to get into it, especially because we have this mantra that everybody has a right to their own personal belief.
Well, Frank, we've run out of time, and I just wanted to, in closing, mention that Rafael Cruz, in his long speech to the Hood County Tea Party in Texas, urged everybody to vote and get politically active, and all of those people vote, and they're all politically active. So, which is something that can't be said for the political left in this country. And I thank you for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Frank Schaefer, who is a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers, and he is the author of a number of books, and his latest is And God Said Billy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Colin Black. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. Bye for now.
Took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. A quiet voice singing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and this land here of the free. One time, one night. One more light goes out in the middle.